gasping rainbow haze at that gigantic white curtain of water, falling with the roar of a thousand thunderstorms. I was lying on a flat stone bank, apparently at one side of the river, and about 2 furlongs from the fall itself. As I say, how I came there, God alone knows. If I'd been a half-decent Christian, I dare say I'd have sent up a prayer of thanksgiving for my deliverance, or I might have marvelled at the devil's own luck that preserves rotters where good men get their cocoa. But neither of these things occurred to me, and my last thought before slipping into unconsciousness as I gazed up at that towering cataract was, I wonder if anyone's ever done that before. I know now that I must have come over the middle of the falls, where the force of the river drives the torrent well out from the cliff, so that I've been thrown clear of the rocky base and landed in deep water. If I'd taken the plunge from the eastern lip, where the current is slacker and the water pours directly down the cliff face, I'd have been mangled on the rocks or drowned in the eddy for certain. Even so, I'd fallen from the height of Nelson's Column, and you need 9 lives to survive that. No one believes it, of course, including the small boy and his sister who found me dead to the wide on the rocky shore, and their fisherfolk parents who nursed me through a bout of fever, malaria by the feel of it, that left me weak as a baby. As for the junior officer commanding the file of Gallus soldiers who arrived when word of my presence had spread beyond the little village, he laughed to scorn the notion that anyone could live through the silver smoke, even if he was a Hindu heretic, and therefore doubtless a sorcerer in league with Shaitan. "For you are Kazim Tamwa, are you not?" says this handsome young savage, smiling courteously as he squatted down beside my pallet in that peasant's hut. "Horse trader out of India, seeking audience with our most illustrious queen, Mastiat the Looking-Glass." And how the devil should he know that? Had I babbled in my fever? Or could word have preceded us from the monastery at Azez? He smiled at my astonishment. The cocky subaltern to the life, for all that his classic features were as black as my boot, and his braided hair was smeared with butter dripping onto his bare shoulders. "It is our business to know who comes and goes along the Abai. And when a foreigner speaking Arabic comes from the north, who should it be but the expected traveller from Hyderabad or some such name?" "Expected, you say? But how?" "No doubt Her Majesty will tell you," says he coolly. "And you would be wise not to insult her with talk of leaping over waterfalls. She is a kind and loving ruler, but she has a short way with liars. Are you fit to travel?" I was, more or less. So after I'd thanked the peasants and dashed them a few dollars, which, with my Jocelyn, had been bestowed in my sash and so survived the fall, we set off through the jungly forest which encloses the Abai beneath the Tisisat. From an eminence about 1 mile south, I was able to get a full view of that extraordinary wonder of the natural world, all 600 yards of it, from the broken cataracts at its western end to the splendid horseshoe on the east. Aye, the devil certainly looks after his own, thinks I, while my gala escort sneered and nudged each other and muttered, "Waka," in Amharic. They were a formidable crew, the very sort of men I'd have expected from my acquaintance with the female of the species, Ulaba Walk. Big, likely youngsters, not one under 6 feet, active as cats, muscled like wrestlers, and African only in colour. Speedy had said that of all the countless Gala tribes, the Wolos were the pick, and I could believe him, and thank God they were Theodore's sworn enemies, for if they'd opposed us, I doubt if one of Napier's army would ever have got back to the coast. They're warriors from their cradles, expert fighters, splendid horsemen, and would rather cut throats than eat dinner. Fortunately for their neighbours, the 50 or 60 families of the nation are never done feuding among themselves, for if ever they united, they could sweep North Africa from the Red Sea to the Sahara. They must be the most independent folk on earth. Those of their tribes who are republican acknowledge no law and pay taxes to no one. And even the Wolos, who recognised Mastiat as their queen, served in her army as volunteers without obligation. There were 12 in my escort, all well-mounted and dressed accordingly, with trousers not unlike Pathan pyjamas under their robes, but barefoot and without headdresses. They were armed with sickle swords and those disgusting ballock-festooned lances, but no muskets or pistols. Their subaltern, whose name was Wedeju, explained that